This is the School Success Podcast, a podcast for school leaders to learn from other school leaders what's working and what's not, and to get inspiration and encouragement, as well as strategies to grow school enrollment, connect with families, retain teachers, recruit teachers, and everything in between. You guys are heroes, and I cannot thank you enough for pouring into this next generation that's coming behind us. My goal is you will take at least one thing away from every episode that you can take back to your school to make it better than it is right now. Please enjoy the School Success Podcast. Hey, school success makers, welcome to another edition of the School Success Podcast. I'm your host, Mitchell Slater. I'm joined by a new friend just a few miles south of me in Hobe Sound, Florida, Mr. Wayne Lynch. And he goes by a couple of different titles. He is currently executive consultant with Global School Consulting Group and also the president of Gift of Hope USA Foundation. So, man with lots of hats, but with a lot of knowledge in the fundraising and helping schools to raise money and things they can do to make more money. And that is what we're going to dive into today, specifically on today's episode. And I'm super excited about this because this is something that continues to come up in the schools that we talk to, or people we've had on the podcast, listeners of the podcast. It's just making sure that they are looking at all the options of how to raise more funds for their school and the steps to do that. So I'm looking forward to diving into that with Wayne today. But as always, before I jump into doing all of that, I always want to pass it back off to the guests to introduce themselves. So Wayne, welcome to the podcast, sir.
Well, Mitchell, thank you for having me. I always enjoy talking about fundraising and schools. It's something that became a passion after 4 or 5 years in business when I first graduated from college. And God kind of called me into the work of fundraising with Christian schools. And so I did both the educational side and the fundraising side, but the necessity for fundraisers took priority. And when I first went into the business, someone said to me, if you start in this field, you will never lack for work. So now I can look back 49 years later and say, that guy was right.
Very good. Well, I love that you're in that industry and it's a huge need, like you said. And it's never, from as far as I can tell, it's never going to go away. It's always going to be a need that schools have, and just knowing how to make certain asks or doing certain programs to raise funds. So I love that we're going to dive into that today. I do always start with the same question, and I'll start it with you. So, and this is kind of funny because I have been to Hobe Sound because it's only about 30, 40 minutes or so from my house. But I always say, if I was to visit Hobe Sound, what would you say, Mitchell, you got to do this and eat this? What would you say I got to do?
Well, you've got to go to Hobe Sound Beach. Up at the north end where the preserve is, because you have 6 miles of uninterrupted, beautiful beach. No houses, just beach and greenery. So I'd say, you know, that's number one about Hobe Sound. Now, what you have to eat, Taylor Beach House, the Mahi Tacos, with coconut rice and black beans. That's the go-to place, especially in the evening when they have music and they got the fire pit going. It's a great place and wonderful people own it.
Love it. And you're very specific of what I have to get there. So you definitely know what you're talking about, it sounds like.
Yes.
Good deal. I love it.
Well, through experience. Yeah, through experience.
Perfect. Well, that one's like, whenever I ask the guests that and they say something that sounds delicious, I'm like, well, I'm probably never going to be able to, you know, get over there and have that. But this one is a reality that I could probably go for my wife and I could have a date night there or something. So
sure.
That sounds delicious. So diving into to fundraising, I don't know where you want to start with that one, because it's pretty, you know, obviously we can go pretty broad. I would love to, I'll kind of ask you some questions that I have out of curiosity. So, you know, we've dealt with some schools that they do a lot of different types of fundraising. And I know the listeners we have, there are different ones that people are doing. There's some that are, I've seen, do more like the gala and tournaments for sports that raise money. And then there's people who are raising funds by selling advertisements. And then there's people who are selling little cards. And then people who ask, just direct asks for people. Like, I would love to kind of see from you, maybe we'll go two different ways on this. What are some of the ones you would ideally tell people to stay away from, and like maybe more of the flops that are not worth the time and investment, and the ones that are like, hey, these work really, really well when it comes to fundraising. Maybe that's a good way to start it off.
Okay. Okay. Underlying principle is that people give to see lives saved and changed. You know, they want to give to see life transformation. So the messaging is so important in fundraising. It's not about the strategies. At a seminar I attended many years ago, someone said, vision eats strategies for lunch. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not about the strategies. It's about having a compelling vision and working from there in building relationships with people. But to specifically answer of do's and don'ts, or what to stay away from and what to engage with, the principle behind improving your school's funding is you have to drive revenues. You can't get your way to success by cutting expenses. You have to increase expenses. So it's driving revenues and increasing expenses to improve the quality of the program. Now, looking at the big pie of all the fundraising, 85% of all gifts come from individuals. So that's your big target market. You know, you target individuals. Now, when it comes to where and how they give, major gifts fundraising is the cheapest way to raise money. So that's building relationships with donors, engaging them in your compelling vision of where you're going in the future, and helping them to see that their gifts can make that preferred future reality happen today. And so major gifts fundraising would be the cheapest, probably, you know, I quote people 15, 18, up to 20 cents on the dollar. Though when you look at the best fundraisers in the country, like Stanford, and you know, they're spending 25 cents on a dollar because you need the infrastructure and the quality. Secondly, I would say deferred gifts, wills, annuities, trusts, having an emphasis on that is one way everybody can give, and it's a big piece of the charitable pie that is often overlooked. Now, those expenses would be roughly, you know, 15 to 20% as well. If you go to specific events, when you factor in the cost and time of personnel and all the rental, the food, you're going to wind up spending about 40 cents on the dollar. And you've got to do the same thing next year. Whereas with major gift fundraising, you get somebody to give a 3-year, 4-year, 5-year pledge. Think how that reduces your cost of fundraising and increases your effectiveness instead of running 5 major gifts a year or 5 major events over 5 years. So I think major gift fundraising is definitely the way to go and should be a priority with any school fundraising program.
Hey, School Success Makers, just a really quick break from the episode to highlight our amazing sponsors over at America's Christian Credit Union. They are celebrating 65 years of service this year, and they provide essential school banking services and a tuition financing program for schools looking to reduce their risk and administrative burden. And you guys can find out all about them on their website, americaschristiancu.com/schools. That's americaschristiancu.com/schools. They are amazing over there, and I always like to say, if you're a school that collects tuition and you have a hard time collecting all of tuition at the end of the year, maybe it comes around May, June, you're like, man, we only got collected 95 or 98% of what tuition was owed to our school. One of the things you can do is have your parents get a tuition financing loan through the credit union, and then they pay the credit union directly, and you get your funds up front at the beginning of the year as the school. So you don't have to chase people throughout the year, and you can focus on what you do best, and that is loving and educating your students. And it doesn't cost your school anything to do it. So check them out online, americaschristiancu.com/schools. All right, back to the show.
All right, so tell me more about big gifts, Wayne. What does that look like, major giving?
Well, I got my first great encouragement from this older Mennonite man that I met the first week I was on my job in fundraising. And he was very gracious and kind. And he told me that one of the things he didn't like about our school was that we didn't write on both sides of the paper. And the paper was in the trash can, unused on one side. And there was a lesson there. The lesson was you need to be listening to your donors. One of the, I'd say the top three skills of a fundraiser are number one, integrity. Number two, listening skills. And number three, loving people. And so Howard became our first major donor as we moved forward to build a gymnasium. And we were using a lot of volunteer help. And the first step was, okay, we have somebody to dig out the foundations, but we need the money to pour the concrete and get the block up to grade level. And that would cost $5,000. So I asked Howard if he would consider being the foundation, because he was the foundation of our fundraising program in those early days. And he said he would think about it. So a couple of days later, he calls me and he said, are you there at school? And I said, yes. It was a Friday afternoon. It was late. Everybody had gone home. He said, I'll meet you at the back door. So he pulls up in this old Rambler and station wagon. And the back of the Rambler is, you know, really loaded and low to the road. And he pulls up and gets out and he takes the wire hanger wire off the handle, and he opens up the car. And he said, I brought you a gift. He said, you have a hand truck. I said, yeah. Well, I got the hand truck. And what he brought me was the gift of $5,000 in pennies. And so I had to unload $5,000 worth of pennies. So I said, where did this come from? And he said, well, I had them in bags. They were uncirculated 1960 pennies. And he thought they'd be worth something someday, and they never were. Well, he had them in paper bags around his basement. One day he comes home in the evening, and the safe that he had in the basement was on the lawn and had been blown open. Here, somebody had robbed his house. They thought that he had money in the safe, and there was nothing in the safe. They blew it up on the lawn for nothing. But they didn't look in the paper bags that were around the basement exterior walls, in which was $5,000 in pennies. So he took that as a sign from God that he had to give us that money. And I think there's a story behind every major gift, and it involves some kind of personal relationship with those people. And the stories year in, year out, over and over, all relate to some kind of personal interaction, which for me is much more fun. I enjoy the big events, you know, I enjoy the galas, but it wears at your staff. And if you had the same staff energy put into major gifts and improving other types of school revenue, I think we would be better funded. So, and the day of the gala, it wears thin on people. Relationships don't wear thin. So that's, you know, my major piece of advice is you build relationships with people who can make a difference in your school. And Gerald Panis was the guru of fundraising. He just passed away recently. But his books are classics. Born to Raise was one of my favorite. And also, you know, Why People Give $1 Million, you know, major donors. So he said, you ask for advice before you ask for money. And that was one of the best pieces of advice I ever got. Because my tools as a fundraiser is not convincing people to give, but it's engaging them. So it's asking questions. What do you think? You know, what are your interests? What are your passions? Where else do you give? And so I like to engage people. And so it's a little longer process. It's more labor intensive, but the final results are much greater.
That's so good. Do you encourage people in schools to use some type of like a CRM platform of keeping track, like a donor management platform, to say like, here's the Smith family and this is their background and what they gave in November, like, or just to do it on pen and paper? Like, what do you suggest for a school to manage that relationship and know who's who?
I find that fundraisers who spend a lot of time behind the computer are not effective. You have to be with and engage with people. So I think starting out for a lot of schools, you know, simple programs, you know, there's Donor Perfect or even Excel spreadsheets. But the idea is, who are the donors? Where is your treasure? Terry Axelrod has a great series of books and training in the Benevon series. And she has this treasure mapping process that I use with schools. And that is, okay, where's your treasure? Where are the things that will help improve the funding of your school? Their individuals, their businesses, their vendors, their connections, their parents, their grandparents. Who are these people and these groups, and what do we know about them? I think that with a lot of schools, they go through maybe a bit of that process, build a database, and then it's lost. And then the next person comes, starts something, then they lose all that he or she gathered. So you have to have some system of gathering names and data, keeping the records, keeping the information, so you know who your top, I would say 25. You got to know who your top 25 donors are and make steps with each one so that you're bringing them closer and engaging them more effectively, step by step in a thoughtful process. You have to map this out. You know, you just, too many are ad hocking it, and you know that's what you get. And you have to wait until people are ready. People aren't ready to give on my timetable for my school. They're ready on their timetable, and this is kind of the tension that fundraisers live with. Especially when school leadership says, well, we need the money today. And, you know, money flows, but it ebbs and flows. It's up and down. And hopefully on a trajectory up and not on a trajectory down.
Do you recommend then for schools who are trying to build these relationships up on a certain amount of a cadence of communication to where you know, you don't like, you don't want to have the relationship where when like you reach out to them, they're like, oh, here we go. He's just going to be asking for money again, you know, like, and then how often should that communication be where you're like keeping in touch once a quarter and giving them updates on the school and where things are at, and then only asking once a year, maybe for something, or what is your kind of coaching when it comes to that for schools?
Well, if you're going to build a relationship with someone, it has to be on more than just money. And more than just their money and your school, it's got to be broader. And so I like to do a lot of social engagements where there's no discussion of money, or, you know, vision trips where they get to see what is happening, you know, at your school or where you're located, those kinds of things. So I used to use tennis. Tennis was a great way to raise money because we played tennis. We built relationships. Now, some people use golf. You know, I've done a little bit of that, but I prefer tennis and pickleball, you know, and some people use fishing. So I think you have to do a lot of social type engagements and interactions with potential donors, so you really get to know them. You also want to get into their homes. You want to see what it's really like with husband and wife. So if I have a prospective donor and he wants to meet, okay, here's your scenario. I don't want to meet him at a power lunch. You know, in a restaurant where it's noisy, you're shouting at one another, you're eating food. I want to be in their home, husband and wife, or whatever the situation is, to get a lay of the land and hear from both. Because major donors do not make decisions, if they're married, without talking with their spouse. So you want to know what's the situation.
How do you suggest them towing that line then of like, does that person then see like, oh, they're just going to be wanting, they just are doing this because they want my money? Like how would you suggest somebody approaching that conversation, approaching those relationships to make sure you don't go into it where they're having that in the back of their mind going, I know why you're doing this. Like I just, that's how I've seen people. I feel like the way they've done it, I'm like, I know why you're doing this, and it gets an icky feeling, you know? So like, what would you suggest for that?
Yeah, well, it's be genuine, be real. And when you're transparent, they open up. And this is one of the things I have seen over the years, time and time again. People will start talking to me about giving and their finances when I have hardly said a thing. And so it's, there is in the back of their mind something to do with, okay, they want me to give. But if you, diffuse the situation, make them feel comfortable, you bring up certain points in a conversation. And I find a lot of people have no one to talk to about their money or their giving. And so that's where I say, well, do you want me to take a look at things? Do you want some help? So where I try to get to, you know, the point I try to get to is I want to help people give to something that I believe is a worthwhile investment for their funds. So I'm going to help people give, but I have to realize I'm not the only game in town. The average person gives to at least 7 different charities, and many give to far more. And then on the other hand, if they do have funds, a lot of people aren't wise in how they're investing it. So I used to, you know, do both sides of the fence. You know, are you being a good steward of what you have? And they said, well, my broker takes care of everything. I don't even know what I have. I remember I visited this couple in in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. And they started off the conversation right where you were, Mitchell. They said, "You're not going to get any money out of us." I said, "Okay, well, I'm not here to get money out of you." And we started talking. And I said, we started talking about the stock market. And I said, "Do you have any investments like that?" "Yeah, but I really don't pay attention. I get all these papers and I don't know what end is up." I said, "Well, would you like me to just look at it and give you some observations?" So I said, "You mind if I make a list for you?" She said, No. You know, and the husband's agreeing to everything. And so she starts making a list as I go through these brokerage reports. And finally she got to, she has a piece of real estate. And she said, "I hate that thing. It is such a pain in the neck. All I do is pay taxes and my niece is part owner." And I said, "Would you like me to help you get rid of that?" "Oh, would you?" So in the same conversation, she's gone from, "I'm not giving you a cent," to now she's talking to me about that piece of property. And I said, "Do you feel like you have enough income?" She said, "Well, I could always use a little more." So I said, "What if I take this and chop it up into pieces and we pay off your niece? We sell the property, we pay off your niece, we get you a charitable gift annuity to pay you a lifetime income, and you can make a donation with the balance." They loved the idea. And so that took place over a period of time. But the point was, she started right out with saying, "You're not getting a penny." Now, on the other hand, I remember Grace vividly. Grace kind of invited me in. She said, "I want to make a gift." And so I asked, "Well, what's your financial situation? Can you afford to make the gift?" And she said, "Nobody's ever asked that." I said, "Well, I'm looking out for your best interests, whether you can make this gift of," I think it was $50,000. So she let me look at everything. And when I did, I said, "Grace, you should not make this gift. It's too much money. You should not make it." She said, "Well, I'll make it whether you like it or not." And I said, "How about we put that in your estate and that you make the gift when you pass away?" So she thought that was a great idea. And we nuanced it a little bit so that when Grace died, she'd asked me to speak at her funeral. So I speak at her funeral. And we had worked it out so that there was a $25,000 check to give to her church, to her pastor who was conducting the funeral. So I was able to give the pastor a $25,000 check at the funeral. And so, because when I was speaking, I said, "Grace was a generous lady. And she demonstrated it throughout her life and even in death." And so I gave the $25,000 to the pastor. And I said, "And she's also made a $25,000 gift to the college." Well, you know, the people loved it. There was an applause. You know, they applauded at the funeral. And I thought, that may be the first time I've seen that. And afterwards, another lady, Mildred, she comes up to me, "You know, that was so cool." She said, "I want to do the same thing." So, you know, generosity breeds generosity, and you got to engage people. And that's why I like to get people together in a room. I love to get a couple entrepreneurs in a room discussing a particular school and their situation and their challenges, because they're going to give you input, and a lot of it's going to be creative. And if you're a good listener, you can make something of that.
Those are great stories, by the way. I love stories because I remember them and I learned from them really well. Do you recommend each school, if they can, have somebody fully dedicated to donor development, like you're talking about, like those relationships, or should that be the head of school that is their main focus to do? Because obviously, what if they leave and then are those relationships gone or torn? You know, so how do you kind of coach a school through that?
Hey, school success makers, just a really quick break to highlight one of our amazing sponsors, and that is ClassReach. Now, ClassReach supports schools of all sizes from application to graduation. Take charge of your school with ease, power, and mobility using ClassReach, the school management software administrators and teachers love using. You can get your free demo at classreach.com. That's classreach.com. They are amazing people, and they provide this amazing SIS software for you to keep track of your students' grades, communicating with families that are enrolled, and a whole bunch more. So again, check it all out on their website, classreach.com. They are awesome. All right, now back to the show.
Yes, well, stability in school leadership is critical to a successful fundraising program and having a compelling vision for the future. You know, if you have those two pieces, then kind of de facto, by default, your head of school is the chief fundraiser in the eyes of the general public. So they must commit some time. Typical college presidents today are spending 50 to 75% of their time in fundraising. Now, when you come down to private schools, K-12 education, it's not that extreme, but they have to spend a good bit of time in fundraising because that's the way they're seen. So then the school needs to have a dedicated fundraising professional who reports directly to the head of school. And you can start out with 2, 3, 4 days a week before you go to full time, and then hopefully build a staff, because you have to look at fundraising as an investment return. If I can invest in somebody, you know, this, you know, 20% cost of fundraising, and they're going to produce 5 times that, why not expand it if you do it in, you know, a systematic, good way, assuming you've got all your ducks in order? So I'm working through this process right now with a school in Budapest. And they have been taking the advice. They're at a point of strength and stability, and they've got a vision for the future. And my advice to them, well, you really need somebody who's Hungarian, somebody who's in the U.S., and somebody who can... who has some experience. Believe it or not, we found the person, a part-time person who was Hungarian, who lives in the United States, and her family is still there in Budapest. Wow. So that's the needle in the haystack. Well, the cool thing is her husband works for major airlines, and she can get back and forth without, you know, the expense. But the point of it is that there are people out there, and you need to find them, and you need to devote resources to your two primary revenue streams, recruitment of students and fundraising, because you want to drive revenues so that you have more funding to do a better job with your teachers and the education of the kids.
What are some of the things that you see schools typically missing out on in terms of like potential revenue growth? So obviously, you know, the quick ones that come to my mind is they have 10 empty seats, you know, boom, let's fill those seats to get the extra revenue. But maybe they're not doing anything with donor development. But is there other things that come to mind that you see going, man, this is just a simple thing that most schools just haven't thought of or aren't doing that could make them another $5,000 or $10,000 a year? Are there any of those that come to mind?
Yes. I have them do brainstorming of alternative revenue streams. Mm-hmm. So, for example, our consulting group was trying to find a director for Kyiv Christian Academy in Kyiv, Ukraine. And we couldn't find anybody. So finally, my associate, David Wells, says, well, why don't you go for a year And I said to my wife, I said, I think David's gone off his rocker. And my wife says, well, why not? So I looked at her. So next thing you know, 3 months later, we're in Kyiv, Ukraine. I said, you know, war with Russia. It's cold. We're near Chernobyl. What's not to like? So we get there. And one of the things I had to do was kind of unravel a financial situation. And we had a lot of facility, but a low enrollment. So I developed a relationship with Fellowship of Christian Athletes, and they rented our basketball facilities, Athletes in Action, and they used the soccer facilities. Then I talked to a local church, and the church moved into our auditorium, brought all their sound equipment, and then we also had discussions. We were setting up a Taekwondo school. So all of these became tenants, and they were generating some substantial revenue. So then when I left Kyiv, then the Russians invaded, to a greater extent than they had before. And those tenants, you know, they're still there. They're still there, as well as a school who lost their building is renting half the school. So, you know, having that kind of revenue generation, and you think, well, I'm never going to need that. I think that's, once again, it's a principle of diversification. You diversify your revenue streams so that you can withstand the ups and downs and the rapid changes that are occurring in our world today.
Yeah, man, that's good. Do you recommend then any, I know we haven't really talked about it, but the, you know, the, we talk about like the donor development, a lot of money coming from there, and then some of the things with the campus. What about just the regular fundraisers that are like, let's do a bake sale. Let's sell these cards for $20 a piece for all the kids to sell. And like, are there some of those you're like, don't do those? Because I know that there's donor burnout that'll happen a lot of times. And I see that with these, usually the smaller schools, they're doing like 4, 5, 6 fundraisers a year with like a little thing here, a little thing here. And I, from my perspective, I kind of like to see schools do one big one or maybe two and kind of like, that's it. Don't be burning people out. But again, you're the expert here. I'd love to kind of see what you think of like, don't do those type of fundraisers.
Yeah, I've made every mistake possible in fundraising because I've been in it so long. And in my earlier years, it was event, event, event. And it was exactly right. It was burning people out. But I was engaging, you know, thousands of people. But then as I started focusing more and more on major gifts, I'm engaging fewer people and I'm raising far more money. So to the point where I was raising a lot of money with just a few donors and I wasn't burning everybody out. I think you have those kind of community building events and fun events because at my kids today, you know, they're in their late 40s, early 50s, and they remember those fundraising events from the 70s and early 80s. You know, they're embedded with this fun, great time that, you know, they didn't have a limit on how much candy they could buy or eat in one day. Those, you know, those funnel cakes and strawberry pies and those kinds of things. So I do warn those fundraisers and look at the costs. You know, it's just like GoFundMe. They say, why don't I have a GoFundMe? You know how much money they take? They're doing the job, but the huge costs of fundraising and these types of things, I find problematic. I mean, not just repeating it and burning people out, but just the cost when you look at the numbers. So I like to be data-driven in education, and I like to be data-driven in my fundraising.
Okay. So if a school is starting up, because I know we do have a good bit of school startups that listen in. If you're starting up a school, what would you tell a startup school to do in terms like there's nothing short of ideas when it comes to like, oh, we could try this, we could do this, we could do this. But if you're like, hey, I want you to just do this and do it with excellence, do it well, and it'll benefit you guys in the long run. What would be kind of like that one thing for a startup school?
Okay. You want to make sure your tuition covers your costs. So don't discount tuition and then have to raise a gap, you know, an annual fund, because that's kind of putting the noose around your neck. And always increase tuition at least the rate of inflation or greater. But then you start right from the get-go on a good long-range plan, a compelling vision, and engaging key potential donors. So it's what these top 25 people, and keeping that as your focus is going to really pave the way to future success, because then it trains everybody. You know, boards are notorious of, you know, the money's in other people's pockets, go get it. You know, well, I there's a principle. I found that organizations that are doing well in fundraising, all their board are giving, and they're giving sacrificially in the sense of equal sacrifice. Not that they're giving big gifts, but they're sacrificing in that all the board gives. So our foundation, one of the first questions our funder asks is, are all the board members giving? So you have to have the board giving, and then the board assigning responsibility to a fundraiser on staff. So you got to start right at the where your people are. You know, it's your tree, and you need to pick the apples off your own tree before you go to somebody else's tree.
Okay. If you're a startup school that's not open yet, then so let's say as we were recording this, it's April of 2024. Let's say you're wanting to launch a school, or they're launching in the fall of 2025. What can donor development and donations start to happen that early for a school? And if so, just casting that vision is all you need to do for those people to say, here's what we're doing next year. Do you want to be a part of it?
Right. And getting pledges. See, they don't have to give right away if you don't need the money. And kind of tailor it to, okay, here are the phases, here are the steps, and here's when we need funding, and see how it fits the particular person. But, you know, a new school startup, often there's a lot of interest in something like that, you know, because it's new, it's exciting, but it has to be properly funded. And the way you do that is getting multiple year major gift pledges that bridge the gap either to some kind of financing or hopefully debt-free, depends on the facility costs.
Is it common for somebody to pledge and then take it back? And I'm going, never mind, I'm not giving.
There's always some that fall through. But my experience is with good people and written pledges that your success rate's going to be 90% plus.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Wayne, as we kind of wrap up the episode, I always do one final question for people. And so it would be, and we've kind of already talked about this a little bit, but if you had one piece of advice for schools that are listening, and if it's around the fundraising world, if it was just one like thing, it could be two, but if he's like, hey, I want you guys to be doing this, or here's a piece of advice from your years of being in this, what would that piece of advice be?
I'd say love people and share a compelling vision of how lives are changed and saved through your work. And it's all about the people.
Amen. I love that. Well, Wayne, if people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way they can get in touch with you and what you guys do?
Okay. I'll just make it simple. WayneKLynch@gmail.com. And I'm pretty responsive, get in touch with people. Or our group of consultants, there's 19 of us, and I'm kind of in the niche of fundraising, but we have everything from board development to curriculum to facilities to safety and all the needs the school has today. So we're full service and multilingual, multi-continent, and multi-country. Our group started out with three of us from Latin America. I was living in Dominican Republic. David and Toby were living in Ecuador. And so the three of us started Global School Consulting Group about 9 years ago. And it's been a joy. It's been a ride. And we've seen a lot of schools helped. And I love working in the hard places.
That's awesome. Love it. Well, thank you, Wayne, for one, thank you for your time today to pour into the listeners and to myself for learning about the fundraising world some more. But thank you also for all your years of helping schools and pouring into them and helping them raise. I'm sure if you added that up, I'm sure you've helped them raise millions upon millions of dollars if you added up all those years of help. So just a huge blessing that you are to these schools and are continuing to be that. So thank you. Thank you again for hopping on. Wishing you nothing but the best as you continue to do what you do best. All right.
Si, senor, está bien.
Well, another huge shout out and a thank you to Wayne for taking time and being on the podcast today. I loved his insight and I loved our interview. I always learn so much from our guests and he was just included in that. I learned a ton from him. So thank you again, Wayne, for hopping on the podcast. As always, guys, I always talk about some of the free resources we offer here at School Success. And one of them is, of course, the one you're listening to right now, the podcast, free episodes dropping weekly. We hope you guys are enjoying it. And if you are, we'd love a 5-star review and for you to share it with your friends, other educators, other people you know in the school and education space. We'd really appreciate that. It would mean a lot to me. So share it out and give us a 5-star review if you love the show. The other free resource is our private Facebook community called School Success Makers. If you're not yet in there, we'd love you to join. We have some great educators from all over the world in there, and that's where you can feel free to ask questions, share different insights or things that you are facing or coming across in your school or whatever you're doing in the education world. Let's go over there and join that group, School Success Makers, on Facebook. I'm personally in there. I'd love to see you in there as well. And our last free resource I want to mention is our School Success Report. It is our weekly email that goes out with great highlights, articles our team has written. We're highlighting some different teachers and educators that are in there. We have a lot of fun stuff planned for that weekly email. We want to make sure you're getting that in your inbox and checking it out. So go to schoolsuccessmakers.com. And in the top right corner, there is a button called School Success Report. Just click that button, put your email in. Pretty simple, straightforward. And make sure you're not missing any of those that are going out every single week. All right. Well, as always, guys, we're going to be back here next week with another awesome guest as usual. We hope to see you then, and I will see you next week on the School Success Podcast. We'll see you then.